So this is two different applications in, of topology. It's a different problems in physics, and both are joint work with Mike Hopkins. So I'm going to spend a good part, starting in an elementary way, telling you some things about topology, and then eventually some of the things we do, and then I'll show you some of the results. And so in the title, we have homotopy theory. Which you can think of as a part of topology, which you should think of as a part of geometry. So geometry is the study of shape. Mathematics is ultimately the study of shapes and numbers. And geometry is the space part, the study of space. And topology, I used to say, topology is the study of kind of large-scale properties of space. Things that you see at a distance that, you know, where you lose the kind of fine structure. So to be a topologist, it's good to be hyperopic, a little bit farsighted. So if you're in a math department, topologists are the ones running into walls, for example. But in fact, I think it's more accurate to say that topology is the study of properties of shapes which really don't have any scale at all. The properties are scale independent. And that's one of the features of topology that gives it some power in applying to physics. So let me just give you a simple illustration of that idea in geometry. Let's suppose that we have a surface, sigma, a smooth surface just in Euclidean 3 space. So in the classical theory of differential geometry, starting with the French geometers and so on, that was one of the objects of study. Before that was plane curves, say, and notions of curvature for plane curves. And if we have a surface, then we also have a notion of curvature for the surface. So we might have a surface like this. And the curvature that I want to look at is a function on the surface, which at each point gives me a real number. This is the Gauss curvature. And it's the product, really, if you like, of the minimum and maximum curvatures of the normal sections of the plane curves you get by chopping it with a normal plane. That's how Euler came to it. And this Gauss curvature is a function. It has units of 1 over area, 1 over length squared. And there are some points with positive Gauss curvature, some points with negative Gauss curvature, and so on. And if we integrate the Gauss curvature over the surface, sigma, say with respect to the area form, then since this has units of 1 over area, that has units of area, this is a dimensionless quantity. And there's a theorem. Well, if we normalize it, then there's a theorem that's called the Gauss-Bonnet theorem that says that this is the Euler number of sigma, let's say in the case when sigma has no boundary. It's a compact surface with no boundary. That's called a closed surface. So this, there are various forms of this Gauss-Bonnet theorem. There are forms for, say, polygonal regions, maybe curved polygonal regions, surfaces with boundary. This particular form was actually apparently discovered first by someone called Walter Van Dyck. Well, he was Walter Dyck, and then he became Van Dyck. He's a little bit lost to history because he was a little ahead of his time. But anyway, that's the theorem. So what it says is that this Euler number, which is an invariant of the surface, which doesn't depend on the induced metric, what's called the first fundamental form in classical geometry, that can be seen at a small scale in the sense that this Gauss curvature is something you compute just in the neighborhood of each point. Of course, we have to integrate it to get this invariant. So that's a kind of small scale, short distance geometry formula for this invariant. But Euler himself gave a formula that usually is written that way, that if we triangulate the surface, we write it as a union of triangles, then we count the number of vertices, the number of edges, the number of faces, we form that alternating sum, and that that integer is equal to the Euler number. So, so that's a kind of interplay between small scale and large scale, if you think about that triangulation as measuring something larger scale. And as I say, if we deform the surface, if we move it, then this quantity doesn't change. It's invariant under that. So often people think that topology is the study of properties that are invariant under those kinds of deformation. Maybe you have a sheet of rubber and you're allowed to perturb it, stretch it, do whatever you like as long as you don't rip it, as long as you don't do something discontinuous. And that kind of notion in topology is called homeomorphism. And it's a reversible process. If you stretch this way, you can stretch back. Homotopy is a more drastic process. It's a non-reversible kind of process. And so let's just see an example of that if we want to calculate the Euler number here. So for example, supposing we have this surface with two holes, green is two surface, then one way you can get it is to take a octagon like this, and we can identify the sides in pairs. So we identify these two like that, these two like that. I hope I'm doing this right. These two like that, and these two like that. Yeah, so if I do that, we'll actually get this this surface like this. So what it means is we're looking at this sort of solid octagon, if you like, this two-dimensional octagon. We're making these boundary identifications. If we do, we get a closed surface, because you see, if I think of a path that goes off here, then that path just continues here, so I don't run off the space. Well, now we want to compute its Euler number, which means we want to count the number of vertices, edges, and faces in a triangulation. We could easily draw a triangulation here and do it, but let me do it a different way. Let me remove a point. So I'm going to just remove a point. Well, I'll have to remember that because that's one vertex I've removed. So I've decreased the Euler number by one by doing that. But now what we can do is, since that hole is there, we can contract this, kind of radially retract this, and widen the hole. And we can keep doing that. And well, if we make this hole actually a little disk, then that's a reversible process. But at the end, I want to keep retracting so that all I see is the boundary. And that's an example of what's called the deformation retraction. That's not reversible. I can't start with the boundary, which is topologically a circle, and I can't, I mean, before the identifications, and I can't recreate what was inside. But that's a homotopy equivalence, and this Euler number is a homotopy invariant. And once we do that, it's very easy to compute what it is, because you see these eight vertices under those identifications just become one point. This edge becomes a circle, and that circle is now identified with this circle. And so you see that there are four different circles. And so the picture just looks like this. And so the Euler number I want to compute is one more than the Euler number of this. That's homotopy invariant. So I've reduced a two-dimensional problem to a one-dimensional problem. And here there's one vertex and four edges, and so you can do the computation from there. So that's just a very simple illustration, but it tells you a little bit about what homotopy means. And the kinds of problems that we'll encounter in physics only depend on homotopy type. So they're not just topological invariants, but they're in fact a kind of homotopy type invariant. And when you have that, that's in a sense a much bigger symmetry group, and so that gives you more techniques to be able to apply. All right. Well, let me say one more problem in topology that will be more along the lines of the one of the two applications I'll discuss, the one that I'll spend most of the time on. And that we can say in the following way. Let's say, what is the space of one-dimensional metric shapes. Well, that's a kind of ill-defined phrase, one-dimensional metric space shapes, but nonetheless, let's think about that. So one kind of shape we might have is a circle. And metric means that I can measure the distance between points. That's what metric means, say. And then, the only thing that I can tell between two circles, I'll be able to say that these two circles are the same for this purpose if they have the same total length. The perimeters, the circumferences, are equal. So then I could make a map from one to the other that is reversible, invertible, and also preserves this metric length. So the space of such circles, let's say, space of such circles what does it look like? Well, it just looks like a copy of the positive real numbers. That's something that looks like this. And the real number there is the length of the circle. Now, I'm saying space, not just set, meaning I want to think that these different circles are held together in a way, that I know how to topologize this. In particular, say I know what a path in this space is, continuous path. So we have to think about families of circles. And, well, we can do that. You can imagine that we have, say, an infinite cone like this. And that cone has cross sections, which are circles. And if I just think of this cone as sitting in Euclidean space, as I did with these surfaces, then these circles have a given length. And in other words, we could think about, say, the projection of this cone onto this line. And if I take a point L here, then the inverse image here, what sits over it, is a circle of length L. And so I could put these circles together into a nice family. And so the parameter space here, you see, is the ray that I drew there. All right, so that's one kind of one-dimensional metric shape. So we could also have two circles. So we could have the space of two circles. So a given point in there would look like two circles. That's again a one-dimensional shape. Now we have a length L1 here and a length L2. And so what is the space of those? Well, the space of those is the space of two positive numbers. So it's positive numbers, ordered pairs of positive numbers that tell you those. Well, it might already be a little bit more subtle because we might not order these circles. There's nothing in the problem that told me I ordered them. So in fact, I have to divide this by the group that exchanges the order. And that already introduces some interesting things because if they have the same length, then something interesting happens. Anyway, my question is, can we find a smooth or continuous path from one circle to two circles? So are those joined by a continuous path in the space of one-dimensional metric shapes? How many people think I can do that? Continuously turn one circle into two circles. How many people think I can't do that? Isn't there an election coming up in Canada? Oh my God. All right. Perhaps not, but you're certainly eligible to vote in this election. I don't know if everything is visible, but all right. Okay, so let me show you two different ways that we can turn one circle into two circles. So, one way we can do it is as follows. Let's picture an infinite cylinder like this. And imagine that I slice the cylinder with planes that go through that perpendicular line. Well, if I slice here, I'll get a circle. And then if I start turning, you see I'll get a longer circle. It's really an ellipse, longer circle. And eventually, as I turn, I'll get two lines. Well, those two lines I can now turn back on themselves in the other way and get two circles. So a better way to draw that might be to say that we have one circle and we want to turn it into two circles. And I'm going to do it by drawing a family of shapes like this. So again, I want to think of this sitting over the line here. And so if I take the pre-image here, then I'll get a single circle. If I take the pre-image here, I'll get two circles. And so what happened? Well, at some particular point here, I got an inverse image that looks like that. So one way I can turn one circle into two circles is by allowing myself a figure eight. That's not what I said here. What I said here would be we just simply take the same picture and we remove that point. And you see what I have there now are two lines. Again, to a topologist, that's two lines. I ignore the metric. But we could put a metric on that does what I said. So there are, in a sense, two ways that we could do it. And to get an interesting problem, I want to disallow both. And disallowing both, I want to think of as introducing a gap condition. So we can say this in in just purely topological terms. I'm not going to allow singularities. So we could say metric shape means smooth manifold. You want something that locally everywhere just looks like the line. And how do we disallow this? We disallow this by asking that the manifolds be compact. We don't want that. So we just have closed manifolds. And if we have closed manifolds, then the moduli space of such, well, it has lots of interesting components. And now I cannot make two circles one circle. Those are separate. OK, those are all theorems one proves in a first graduate course in differential topology. Now, why do I say it's a gap condition? Well, if you think about the metric, you can think about the Laplace operator, just the second derivative operator, with respect to that metric. And if you think about what happens to the spectrum, on a circle, the spectrum is discrete. But when we get to this one, what happens is that the gap between the lowest and the next eigenvalue has disappeared because we now get another eigenvalue coming down to zero. We have two zero eigenvalues here, locally constant functions. What happens here is that, again, as we lengthen the circle, now the whole spectrum comes down and becomes continuous spectrum. So there are two different spectral ways, one discrete and one continuous, in which we've gone from one circle to two circles. So if we don't, so the moduli space of these one-dimensional shapes has, we can ask short-range and long-range questions. The short-range questions having to do with the details of the metric, things like the length of the circle and so on. Long-range question is, for example, can we connect one circle to two circles? That's the question of deformation classes of circles, or in terms of the space of these circles, what's called pi naught, meaning the path components. And in this case, pi naught is isomorphic just to the non-negative integers, meaning that I just have to count how many circles there are. There could be no circles. The empty set is a manifold of any dimension, as it happens. Or there could be one circle, two circles, and so on. And that tells us, if we have two pairs of circles, again with metric, with length, we just have to know if they're the same number to know whether I have a path joining them. And so that's the problem of deformation classes. Well, the physics problem, the first one that I want to discuss, is the problem to classify gap phases of matter. Well, that we have to put some definitions to make sense of that question, of course. The same way we have to put definitions on one-dimensional metric shape. Now, one-dimensional metric shape, I know how to do that. We have a good theory of smooth manifolds. We have a good theory of dimension of a manifold, and so on. that wasn't always the case, of course, if you go back 19th century, but it is the case now in the 21st century. However, these gap phases of matter, what do I mean? Well, I don't have a definition there. So we're talking about some kind of quantum mechanical systems, let's say. And so maybe there's a Hilbert space of states, there's a Hamiltonian, there's a spectrum of energy, the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. Gapped, therefore, has a meaning, basic bifurcation between quantum systems which have a spectral gap above the minimal energy and ones where the continuous spectrum comes down. So these are the ones that have a gap. But what do I mean? Well, furthermore, we not only have to say what a single system is, but we want to make sense of a space of these, moduli space. Just the same way we talked about a moduli space of circles. And so typical examples in physics, say in condensed matter physics, these might be lattice systems of some sort. These could also be quantum field theories of some sort, or even string theories of some sort. But really for today, we want to think about lattice systems. Well, in all moduli problems in geometry, to get a well-controlled problem, you usually have to fix discrete invariants. So in the problem I gave you here, the discrete invariant is 1, the dimension. We could have asked this question for 2-dimensional manifolds, 3-dimensional, and so on. And here, the discrete invariants that one wants to fix are, for example, the dimension of the quantum system, maybe lattice system. Or you might want to fix, as well, I mean, the symmetry type. Let's call it some kind of symmetry. And so we want to get a good moduli space, and we want to get that. And if we had such a moduli space, which depends on a dimension and a symmetry type, then the question is to compute the phases. So what are phases? Well, phases are the issue of whether I can draw a path continuously from one quantum system to the other. If we can, then we'd like to think that qualitatively they look similar. So that's the question of pi naught, just as it is there. And I told you about Euler number. I didn't point out when I talked about pi naught that this is actually a homotopy invariant. So even if I don't know this moduli space in detail, I would need to know it if I'm going to ask detailed questions about correlation functions and so on. But if I want to ask this question about phases, then I only have to know this M up to homotopy. So we could say we want to compute the homotopy type of this moduli space. Of course, that's much more information. This is the most simple information from that homotopy type. So the first problem, what I'm going to tell you, is a kind of proposal for what that should be for a special case when these phases are what's called invertible. So I'll have to explain that. Let me just, to make this only slightly more concrete, the standard kind of first example of a phase portrait is for H2O, where you have temperature and pressure. And I said that to get a good moduli problem, we fix dimension and symmetry. What I didn't say is that we have to also throw out a bad locus. We want to throw out, for example, in this problem, we threw out these kinds of singularities and that kind of non-compactness. And similarly here, in this problem, what you throw out are the phase transitions. And so those occur in something like locus like this, or something like that. And so if we're at room pressure, it looks like there are three phases. This is ice, water, and vapor. But at high enough pressure, there are actually only two. And in terms of the two variables, there are two. So those are the path components, and those are the phases of H2O. So that's the kind of question that's here. All right. Thank you. So as I say, we don't have any definitions, so how are we going to attack this problem? Well, we're going to move it to a place where we do have definitions and therefore have techniques that we can do. And I want to move to a problem in field theory. Well, how do I do that? Well, it's any time you apply mathematics outside of mathematics, you're going to have to make some kinds of jumps and assumptions and so on to formulate a mathematical problem. And here we use kind of two principles. One that are just heuristics. They're not meant to be proved or even justified. One is that the phase, say, is determined by the long distance behavior. And the second one is that the long distance behavior if gapped is well approximated by a field theory, and in fact, a topological field theory. Now, this one is probably more or less okay, even though, again, you don't have definitions or some way to prove it. This one is more problematic. There are many examples now of, say, lattice systems, which don't seem to have topological field theories and so on. It's also more problematic in a kind of subtle sense that one doesn't quite expect topological, but I'm not going to elaborate on that now. But this does seem to hold a lot of the time. And if we do accept that, then the question becomes one of classifying or compute pi naught, say, of some other moduli space with the same kinds of discrete parameters, or at least matching parameters, where this is now a moduli space of field theories, and essentially topological field theories. And topological field theory is something where we have lots of definitions. I don't think you'll see there. And so there are definitions that we've been, or really axiom system, that we've been playing with, we mathematicians, for over 30 years that came out of the kind of Oxford School of Geometry. Graham Siegel introduced for conformal field theories in two dimensions in the mid-80s, and then later Michael Attia, a variation for topological field theories, and there have been many elaborations and so on since, not only of definitions, but of theorems. And so there's a lot that one has, and that's what we can draw on to say something about this problem. But again, we have to move it to field theory in order to do that. So what is a field theory then? Well, so a topological field theory is a map, has a domain and a codomain. It's a function, if you like. And it maps from some manifolds, if we're in n dimensions, n minus 1 and n-dimensional manifolds, it maps them into vector spaces. So if we had a group here, and I told you I had a map of a group into vector spaces, you might, a group acting on vector spaces, you would think that's a kind of linear representation. And at first glance, this means it's a kind of linearization, a linear representation of manifolds. But what structure is that? Well, we don't have a group, we don't have invertibility, but this is a category. The objects of the category are closed N manifolds, Y, say, N minus one manifolds, rather. And those map to F of Y, which is a vector space. And in terms of field theory, you should think that this is axiomatizing some kind of Wick rotated field theory, and that this is therefore a space, not space-time, but a space on which you have the theory. You would think of this perhaps cross-time, the infinite cylinder, and you might quantize the theory, or think of the space, quantum space of states on that space, and that's what this vector space is meant to represent. So, but this is a kind of stripped down version. This is just a vector space. There's no inner product, say. But still, it's a vector space over the complex numbers, and that encodes superposition, the vector space structure, interference, the complex numbers. So the intuitions of quantum mechanics are in that definition. And then this category has morphisms, maps, which are precisely the kind of thing I drew there, the Bordisms. And so this is a Bordism X. You can think of it starting with some manifold Y naught and going to a manifold Y1. And this maps over to a linear map. And you should think of that as encoding, well, on the one hand, a kind of evolution, as if this were time evolution, but it's Wick rotated, so there's no idea that it should be unitary. In fact, there's nothing unitary in this definition. You could also, out of this definition, encode correlation functions, partition functions. So all the usual characters in field theory are encoded in this definition. And there's a way of, there's an operation here of disjoint union, which corresponds to taking, you know, a space in two parts, if you like. And that maps over to tensor product, which is what happens in quantum theory when you combine systems. So in fact, we could take a whole theory. If we have two theories, we could tensor the theories using this tensor product. That's an operation that in condensed matter is often called stacking, but it just means I have two quantum systems and I consider their union without interaction. That's a kind of composition law on quantum systems. And once we have that composition law, which has an identity, there's a trivial theory, then we have a notion of invertibility, just the same as we have for square matrices. Square matrices have an associative composition law with a unit, and so we know a square matrix is invertible if there's another square matrix whose product is the unit. So, okay. So our problem, you see, is we're thinking of these topological field theories as attached to a more complicated physical gap system. And this is the low energy part, deep infrared, if you like, just the vacuum. And so this invertibility condition is saying, in particular, that on every space, there's a unique vacuum. And that's a condition that does occur in certain systems, say lattice systems. And so those are the kinds of systems that we're classifying. Okay. Right. So there's much more to say, of course, about about all of this. Let me just say a few things, quickly introduce the second problem, and then I'll show you the results. So as I say, this definition has been around for 30 years, really in the form I've told you. But we need to soup it up in different ways. And two of the ways, well, the ways we need to soup it up are to encode locality and unitarity. So it's often said the two pillars of quantum field theory are locality and unitarity. This definition has locality built in to some extent because we can compose Bordisms by following one with another one and gluing, and then it says these compose. That's a kind of locality that I can cut in codimension one. But a strong form of locality would allow me to compute something by chopping this up into just small balls, just small pieces. And so I need manifolds with corners and so on. And so there's an extended notion of locality, a sort of extended field theory, in which Now we simply have a Bordism category that has manifolds of all dimensions less than or equal to n, but now they have corners, not just boundaries. And they map to some more complicated gadget, which at the top looks like vector spaces for n and n minus 1 manifolds, but we don't really know a good universal choice for something to go there. But anyway, there's a notion of such a field theory. It's a very useful notion in purely mathematical contexts. And I think one thinks that a physical system, you know, certainly a field theory, should be local in the sense that it obeys this kind of thing, even not topological, just ordinary quantum field theories, although that would be a complicated structure. So these are complicated already algebraically. They're called n categories. They have lots of n composition laws, essentially composing in the n directions that you're chopping the manifolds. Unitarity is something that's quite easy, once you wick rotate, to incorporate into that context. But actually, it was a question that never occurred to me, certainly, but I don't know if others, of incorporating unitarity in this extended locality context. And that's something that Mike and I did in this, one of these projects in the case of invertible field theories. So that was the kind of new thing, was to incorporate an extended notion of unitarity in the invertible case. Now, what does it mean to say that it's invertible? Well, to say it's invertible means that every object that I attach to a manifold at whatever codimension is invertible. So inside this category is some kind of sub-object of all the invertibles. So if we were back in the category of vector spaces, this is the category whose objects are vector spaces, and the maps between them are linear maps, which may or may not be invertible. Inside of it is the groupoid of lines. Those are one-dimensional complex vector spaces. Those are invertible under tensor products, and the only maps we keep between them are the invertible maps. So we throw out everything that's not invertible, objects, morphisms at all levels. That's what this is. And to say a theory is invertible means it factors like that. Well, if you have a map that factors like that, it would be like in ring theory, where you have a ring and you're mapping into something where everything is invertible, then the map factors through a quotient where, this is a sub, but this is a quotient where we invert everything. So we just formally adjoin inverses. And so we could think of our invertible field theory as a map here. Now, I'm not in a colloquium going to explain details about what that is, but once we have everything invertible, this is no longer this kind of world of categories. We can think of this in the world of spaces. In other words, the world of ordinary topology. And the fact that these spaces have a composition law, which is the disjoint union here and some kind of tensor product here, means that these spaces are what are called infinite loop spaces. And those are the province of homotopy theory, in fact, the part of homotopy theory called stable homotopy theory. And so our problem becomes a problem in stable homotopy theory. And so that's where the techniques for what I'll show you lie. All right. Now, I just want to say one more word before going to the slides, which is about the second problem.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I just asked something. Maybe you said it, but I missed it. What's the physical meaning of being invertible?
Physical meaning, I was also going to give you examples, but I think I'm running out of time, so you can ask after for examples. The physical meaning is that it's a field theory where there's a unique state on every manifold, or that's one consequence, let's say. Now, you might think that such a theory is necessarily trivial. All I have is a kind of vacuum state. Of course, in a topological theory, I only have vacuum anyway. There's no motion. But now I just have one, so what can possibly happen? Well, there are things that can happen. But in the context where we're approximating a physical system, which is gapped by the vacuum state, it's saying that in this larger physical system, there's a unique vacuum state. So you should think of it that way. And you can ask me for examples later, but let me say one more place There are several places, actually, where these invertible field theories play a role in more complicated field, in the context of a more complicated field theory or string theory or whatever. But another place is in what's called the study of anomalies. So I said that a field theory is a map like this, and that we might call now an absolute field theory, but we could also have an anomalous field theory. And so roughly speaking, an anomaly is, but again, there's an asterisk, an invertible field theory, one dimension higher. And so what does it mean to have an anomalous theory? It means that, so that's the anomaly, and F has anomaly alpha if it is a map from the trivial theory to alpha. And so maybe the most intuitive way for you to think about it is to think that I have really a domain wall that's F. On one side of the domain wall, I have alpha. On the other side, I have the trivial theory. So if you like, you can think that F is a boundary theory for alpha. And that's what an anomaly is. Anomalous theory is F, and the anomaly is alpha. So let me just point out something right away from this definition. We can't talk about F until we know alpha. F is a map from 1 to alpha. I have to know the domain and codomain before I can even tell you what F is. So when we have an anomalous theory, we already know it's an anomaly. And the anomaly is an important invariant of the theory. And there's a lot to say there. But I'm not going to say more. I'll say more in the slide. So maybe that's a good enough place for me to switch to slides. It'll take a second for that to happen, I think.
Maybe then while we wait, not obvious that all anomalies are of this type, but if you take the conformal anomaly, it's not clear.
The conformal anomaly is of this type, but the two-dimensional conformal anomaly is the reason I put the asterisk there. But let me answer that after. That doesn't look good. Let's try. Request assistance. I could press that. There it is. All right, so you can dim the lights wherever God is hiding in the booth. So.
It could happen.
So what I didn't say is, but fortunately. I think that's perfect. So I said that when we start by knowing manifolds, the domain of a field theory. When we have an extended field theory, we know general principles of superposition, interference, that might govern this, but we don't really know the codomain. But when we have the invertible case, we get this quotient obtained by a well-defined process. And this quotient that we get is, as I say, an infinite loop space. And it's an infinite loop space that's tied to Bordism. Bordism being something that, as you see, Poincaré already, in a sense, started as a smooth form of homology. In Poincaré's day, he was confused maybe about manifolds and simplices and all that, what the difference between Bordism and homology. But this has to do with Bordism. In fact, this is not the standard Bordism that was later defined by Pontryagin and Thom, but rather this is a different version that's a kind of unstable version. And the result of this unitarity, or in the Wick-rotated version, reflection positivity, is that the theorem is that we get back to actually the Thom Bordism. But anyway, we're going to see this Bordism coming up in this classification of these invertible phases. And the only intuition, I just wanted to remark, that the only conceptual reason I know that Bordism occurs is here, from field theory, ultimately because of this axiomatization of field theory, which in a sense has Bordism encoded. Tia's paper already points out the relation with Tom. I think it was actually dedicated to Tom. So that's the reason Bordism is there. I don't know any independent reason. I put also Frank Adams here, because the techniques we'll use are the techniques that Frank Adams developed in the 1960s, the Adams spectral sequence. And I'll just remark that these four gentlemen were doing their mathematics with no idea that it would apply, for example, to condensed matter physics. All right, so the main theorem in one of those papers is telling the homotopy type, really, as I said, of a moduli space of these invertible field theories, topological field theories of dimension n and certain symmetry type. And it has reflection positivity built in. And so here's the answer. So I don't expect you to absorb. There's no quiz. But just take some general things away. One is that we give these discrete parameters, the dimension and the symmetry, and then we write a formula. It's a uniform answer, right? It's a kind of formula. And what is the formula? The formula is it's homotopy classes of maps from something to something. But I said we might want the homotopy type, and the homotopy type is the mapping space. This is pi naught of the mapping space. And the domain is a Thom spectrum. That's René Thom's brilliant 1954 thesis. He gave this relation, this homotopy theory way of computing Bordism groups. And that's the spectrum that he came up with. The symmetry here is tied to the dimension, but this Thom is a stabilized version, and we need a stabilized version of the symmetry. So one part of this theorem is developing a theory of symmetry in quantum field theory to prove that you actually have a stabilized group. The codomain, I told you here that we don't know a general codomain for field theory, but in the invertible case, there is a magical answer that has many nice properties. And that's the one there, and it's related to the sphere, which is a basic object, kind of the spectrum version, infinite loop space version of the integers in homotopy theory. All right. So I told you when I wrote down these principles that there was topological star, and here it means they might not be topological, these invertible field theories, and we don't really have mathematical infrastructure quite fully developed. But here we get the torsion subgroup, the elements of finite order. What we really want is the entire group. All right. So this anomaly question is the second of the two problems. I'll talk about it first. And the particular problem here is M-theory. So M-theory is an 11-dimensional theory. Again, we don't know perhaps what M-theory is. It's some form of string theory. But there's a version of it that's expressed in terms of field theory, supergravity, with a little bit of a correction. And in the mid-90s, Witten showed that the theory was consistent in a certain sense, but not with time reversal symmetry, so on spin manifolds. And there are possible inconsistencies precisely from this anomaly that's now hidden. And so what we want to show is that the alpha that occurs for a given theory is actually trivializable. And even more, you want to give a trivialization. If you trivialize it, then your theory maps one to one. And that's an usual theory. That's what you want to do. So a piece of data for a theory is really to give a trivialization of the anomaly, which again is a problem that's in topology. We'll talk about the anomaly and its trivializations. So Witten asked the question, I think partly motivated by time reversal invariance being very much in the air because of condensed matter physics, whether M-theory indeed is consistent if we allow time reversal, which means we're formulating it on non-oriented manifolds, possibly non-orientable manifolds. So there are two sources of anomalies. One is from the Rorieder-Schwinger field, which is a fermionic field, a spinner-like field, and the fermionic path integral always has an anomaly. And the other one is this C field in M theory, which has a certain cubic form, and the way it's normalized and so on also leads to an anomaly. And so the question is whether, when I take them all into account, I get something trivial. The result is that, in fact, it is trivializable. And to check that, well, the anomaly is a 12-dimensional invertible field theory. And so what we have to do is check whether this theory is trivial. And it's enough to say that we can check the partition function. We check it on some 12 manifolds. And so we had to find the right generators to check. So this invariant is actually a Bordism invariant. But the Bordism group is non-standard. It's pin plus manifolds. That's the version that admits spinners of the right type to get the Rurita-Schwinger. But there's also a funny condition related to the C field. Anyway, we calculated that. I'll show you in the next slide what that looks like. And there were six generators. These are rather funny manifolds. This one, for example, is a it's a bundle of the connect sum of two quaternionic projective spaces sitting over the real projective RP4. This one is an RP8 bundle over S4, and so on. So these are kind of complicated manifolds that were fun to find and also fun to calculate these invariants. Now the question is, how many trivializations of alpha are there? And there are two. This is being very, very cautious to write conjecture. I'm sure that's right, but strictly speaking, somebody probably in the audience is going to prove it. So here's the kind of chart that one gets. This is the picture of the input into the atom spectral sequence, kind of X chart. And here you see the different dimensions of these kinds of manifolds. Some of the manifolds are identified, Klein bottle, K3 surface, Bott manifold, and so on. And the result about the six generators, they occur in this column with the 12. The output is this algebra with some clues. You have to find the manifolds to do that. And the result about the different trivializations, well, if you have one trivialization, you can tensor it by an invertible 11-dimensional theory to get another one. In other words, they form a torsor over the 11-dimensional ones. And ostensibly, there are three generators, makes it look like it's Z mod 2 cubed. But in fact, there are differentials here that kill those. Well, that's the part that someone has to check more carefully, but I think that's there. So that's one result. So again, I didn't show you, there's a paper, I'll give you the reference at the end, with lots of computations and so on, to check that on those manifolds this anomaly vanishes. It's a bad proof. I mean, it's a proof by computation and checking. It's certainly not a conceptual proof. Witten gave a very conceptual proof in the case without time reversal, but we don't know of such a proof here. All right, so back to the other problem. The other problem, as I said, is to classify, well, to find the moduli space of these gapped invertible lattice systems, the dimension, people in condensed matter system talk about the space dimension of space rather than space-time. So that would be called the dimension of space and symmetry type, certain symmetry type. And right. So that's the space we want. I told you there were these two kind of principles, heuristic principles we use to get to a problem in field theory. And so we use those. And as it says, it would be nice to make a mathematical justification. So that's, as I say, always true. When you extract a problem, you could try to do better the next time and make more of it mathematics. OK, and so we're going to use this formula that once we have a problem in topological field theory, here's this moduli space of these invertible topological field theories, and the main theorem computes it this way. The topological ones are the elements of finite order, but in fact, this star here is indicating that we want all the elements. All right, so I'll just show you some sample computations. So in our paper, we actually considered 10 special symmetry types. So the symmetry type is written here. That's the group H, the stable group. And the dimension is written here. Those are the two discrete parameters. And the reason we chose those 10 is that they model kind of electron systems. And for those, there's a version also of a free theory. And so that's the choice of the 10 is called the tenfold way. That was actually introduced in a paper of Freeman Dyson. The paper is called the threefold way, but the paper, and that's what people remember. But in fact, inside the paper, there's a tenfold way. And there are many different tenfold ways. We give yet another, a kind of relativistic derivation of these 10 different symmetry types. And it's interesting to know how they would all fit together. Anyway, as I say, there's a free version. And the free version is in this column. That, in the condensed matter context, was Katayev and others who recognized the relation with K-theory. kind of shifted version of real K-theory. This column are the topological phases. These are the ones that we compute by the Wardism formula. And there's a map between them. And if we have a free system, we could consider it as interacting. And that map, too, has an avatar. I mean, this map is expressed in homotopy theory. It's actually a version of what's called the Atiyah-Bhatt-Shapiro map, which maps spin-boardism to the KO theory. This is a transpose. We're mapping out. We get theories. So it goes from functions on one to functions on the other, and it's a twisted version to get these different types. Anyway, it's something computable is what you should take away. So we can not only compute these groups, but we can compute the map between them, and therefore compute the kernel and the co-kernel. The co-kernel, which is zero here, but in other examples, it's not zero. Those are interacting theories that you don't see from free theories. You don't get them by starting with a free theory. And the kernel means that it's a free theory, which when you allow interactions, becomes connected to the trivial theory. Okay. So these appear in the literature, computed in condensed matter. For example, this first one, the Z mod 16, going from Z to Z mod 16 is a quite well-known one. And so here's one paper, just to kind of illustrate the disparity in techniques, talking about insulators and superconductors. That's the tenfold way, as it says. This is the pin plus that I'm talking about, and it said, at this point, which is only a few years ago, that attention is turned away from the free case, basically, to the interacting case. And here you see that the answer, that Z is reduced to Z mod 16. And you see that the kinds of arguments have to do with Majorana cones, Dirac cones, and so on and so on. They're very different than the charts and the X and the groups and the cobordism and all that we use, but we get the same answer. So I just wanted you to have a visual of that. Here's, again, these charts. That's how one computes. The particular one we're doing is this case. There are 10 such boxes. They're not all drawn here. And this is the column in dimension 4, degree 4, in this axis. And you see here these dots each represent a cyclic group of order 2. The lines mean they're extended, so this is an iterated extension. So we get something of order 16. That's the Z mod 16. And what's above it was in the free theory, but it was killed in the interacting theory. So that's how the computation looks. Okay, so there are many more computations, and some of you in the audience now are certainly better than I am at these. Jonathan was a postdoc at UT, and I kind of introduced him and told him this is a good thing you can bring to market. And so he did. So this is just to illustrate. We're not restricted to these 10 electron types. This was some kind of superconductor, a certain symmetry type. And here you see a little bit more of the kind of mathematics, the topology that goes into the computation. So there are computations that match what the physicists got, the condensed matter physicists. There are new ones, new corrections, and so on and so on. So one final comment is that the interest is not only in these kinds of universal phases, but also phases on a particular space. So you might, for example, take a one-dimensional, one space-dimensional phase, like called a Majorana chain that lives on a line, and you might pluck that line in three-dimensional space. And maybe you say it's invariant under a half twist, and maybe you want to know what all such phases are. Is that connected? So you want to know what phases are on a space, or a space with a group action, stack, and so on. And Kataya, of course, has been approaching this problem from the condensed matter point of view and has the idea is that it should form a generalized homology theory that we can push forward from the line to stick it in a bigger space. It's Borel-Mohr homology, the line being not compact. And so using what we did before, which is this Bordism mapping spectrum, we can make a generalized homology theory based on it. We have to make it equivariant. That also has the name Borel attached to it. And so it's not hard to guess. So it's an ansatz that the correct group of those symmetry types on a particular space with a group action is given by this. So that's a little bit more complicated to calculate, but it's certainly highly calculable. And again, in condensed matter, that's still something people are doing, is calculating, for example, one case is Euclidean space with a crystalline group, calculating the phases, and this formula, that's a very special case. I should say the case when Y is Euclidean space with no group, then that gives you the answers we had before. That's what those phases are. Okay, thank you.
So, do you have, you mentioned that you have this issue of, or this open sort of question about connecting lattice based models to the sort of functorial field theory description. Do you have ideas of how you might be able to do that in some cases, or?
Not really.
Or to go backwards even?
But you mean start from a field theory and construct the lattice model?
Mm-hmm. At least some way to sort of connect it with the...
Well, Davide and others are certainly working on that kind of thing. And I mean, there are papers before that by Walker and his collaborators that do that kind of thing. You could imagine that if you have a fully extended field theory, that you could, make a kind of, once you have that, you can compute something for a triangulated manifold, essentially, right? And so you could imagine that you could get to something discrete. For example, there's a topological field theory in three dimensions called Thrive-Vero models that are fully extended. But Thrive and Vero, I think, anyway, people introduce those as kind of lattice sums, whatever they're called. And you can connect, that extended field theory with those sums by, in fact, I had a student do that in two dimensions. Her thesis is exactly to do that. Use the notion of extended field theory to derive those state sums, they're called, from extended field theory. So you can imagine, that some problems might be handled that way in that direction. In the other direction, as I say, if you just give me a lattice model on flat space or pieces, there's nothing that says that it should have a good field theory approximation. That was the second of the principles that's problematic. And one idea would be that you build something into the theory that says you can do that, which I view as analogous to saying when you define relativistic field theory, nobody, in a sense, told you without you putting something in that you could put it on a curved manifold, Lorentz, much less quick rotate to Riemannian. But, the field theories that come up, whether in the standard model or all the ones around, there's a set of words that are code words, like Majorana fermion in this dimension with gauge field with adjoint blah, and those words encode exactly what to do on every manifold. And so you could imagine that there's a better class of lattice systems where that information is given in advance. And maybe that's a better context, or at least as a start, to try to understand when you should be able to make the connection. But I don't really have any developed ideas.
Any more questions from the general audience?
Maybe I can ask a very basic question. I still was a bit confused by these field theories that only have one vacuum. Then what type of physics question do you ask? What quantity do you compute?
Well, let me get rid of the slides. And maybe the lights can come back.
I'm not totally confusing myself. So, for example, a massive scalar is an example, I guess, right?
The low energy part of that would be an example, yes. But that by itself would be a free theory,
right,
if we just have that. So let me give you an example of an invertible field theory. So this is a map as I said, from it's going to be two-dimensional, and it'll be on spin manifolds, and then we'll map somewhere. But at the top, we see it's invertible, so we see lines. But there's another piece to get the zero manifolds. Anyway, this theory alpha might be called the ARF theory. And so if I evaluate it on, say, a two-manifold, which is so this should be a closed spin manifold. So it has a picture that looks like that, but with some particular spin structure chosen, then this invariant is plus or minus 1. It's minus 1 to what's called the ARF invariant in X. So the ARF invariant, say it's a connected surface, tells you whether it's an even or odd spin structure. So that's something that occurs in string theory, for example. And so that's a 0 or 1, whether it's even or odd. And in topology terms, it's asking whether it bounds, whether there's a three-dimensional spin manifold that's compact, of which this is the boundary. So that's the partition function of this theory. And we could evaluate it on a circle. On a circle, we get a line, but I should have said superlines, meaning that we get a grading. So the grading means the line is either even or odd, and even or odd corresponds to whether the unique state is bosonic or fermionic. And here again, there are two circles. There's a bounding circle, and there's a non-bounding, which physicists sometimes name after Novo Schwartz and Ramond, I think. And this one is the line which is even, and this is the line which is odd. So you get a unique state that's one or the other. And then we could go further and say what we get on a point. Okay, so that's an example just to show you something non-trivial. And in fact, any Bordism invariant can be made into a invertible field theory. That's kind of the result and how the homotopy theory looks, which just from the mathematics point of view, by the way, is already interesting. You have a Bordism invariant. It says you can compute it in a fully local way by chopping up. Now, how does this theory arise in physics? Well, there are several ways. So one way is if we take, there's a lattice model in one space dimension called the Kataev-Majorana chain. And if we take its low energy theory, that's meant to be this one. That's one way in which it arises. It could also arise as the anomaly of a one-dimensional theory. And if you take a, if you take just a spinner field in one dimension, and if you ask that it admit a mass, then the number of real functions you need has to be even. And if you take a number which is 2 mod 4 of those functions, that theory is anomalous, and this is its anomaly. So it arises in that way as an anomalous field theory. I mean, it arises in other ways too. So anomalous field, invertible field theories arise in a sense as a tool or piece in the structure of other problems one might be doing in definitely non-invertible and non-topological field theory. But it's a piece you can really get your hands on.
Thank you.
Any more questions?
From the general audience. So you say that, I feel that this is like a PhD defense. You're going to let all the students go and really start asking questions. What? Oh, you're, yeah, he's eager. Oh, I see. Okay, sorry. Another question.
Just a quick one. In this case, what is assigned to the point?
What is what?
What is assigned to the zero manifold or to zero manifolds?
Ah, well, we have a choice to make, as I say, of what we put here. Okay, so I said in the slides that there's a universal choice, and the universal choice is a kind of dual, Henderson dual to the sphere spectrum, and what we can put here is that universal choice, but truncated to the part we would see in two dimensions, and that part then has a realization in more concrete terms, which is as super algebras. But they should be invertible, which in pure algebra theory means they're central simple. But central simple in the context of Z2 graded, with the Clausius sign. So this is a kind of Morita category. The maps between them are bimodules, so they have to be invertible because we're just taking the groupoid here. And there are two Morita classes. And the non-trivial one is represented by the Clifford algebra with an odd number of generators, for example, this Cliff 1. And so this theory being not trivial, that's what has to be attached to a point. But we might envision we took other kinds of targets there, and then we would have something different that would occur. But that's the simplest way to say it.
How does that algebra relate to the lattice model?
Yes. I mean, in the lattice model, I think what happens is if you have your Majorana chain and you cut it, and you think about the operators, the algebra of operators on the boundary, that's what you see in the Majorana chain as a Cliff 1.
Any more questions? Can I speak again?